From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, voices from right-wing media are turning against Donald Trump. What are the stakes for Michigan?
It's causing people to re-examine everything in a way that hasn't been done since the last election.
Also, a violinist born in Tehran talks about this moment in world affairs and communicating with each other through music.
This has been just a very tumultuous few past months. First was the oppression of the regime itself, and then right after that was the attack of U.S. Israeli military.
Plus, writer Curtis Chin is this year's Great Michigan Read. We'll revisit his memoir, Everything I Learned in a Chinese Restaurant.
Do I stay in this comfortable situation with my family and all the free Chinese food I could eat? But at the same time, the city is falling apart around us.
Those stories coming up today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, writer Curtis Chin talks to us about growing up between the tables of his parents' Chinese restaurant.
We'd have these conversations just sitting in the back of the restaurant where I'd ask her about her view of the world. And she would always surprise me with her responses, and in a good way.
His memoir is the next Great Michigan Read, and we're going to hear from him later this hour. But first, we need to take a minute to touch base on what's happening overseas. The tentative ceasefire in the Iran war is under strain. Israel is still bombing Beirut as a side conflict involving Iranian-based Hezbollah forces. Lebanon reports that at least 203 people were killed and more than 1,000 wounded on Wednesday. And Tehran maintains its grip today over the Persian Gulf Strait of Hormuz. Here in the United States, something unprecedented is going on among figures who've been, until now, rock-ribbed supporters of President Donald Trump. It hasn't been uncommon in the past year to hear people with experience in foreign service sounding concerned about the Trump administration's ultra-belligerent approach to world affairs, and same for academics and certainly Democrats in Congress. But this week, some very different voices have been speaking out. Political commentator Tucker Carlson urged Americans in positions of power to refuse to carry out illegal war orders. Podcaster Alex Jones, infamous as a conspiracy theorist, called Trump's threats to bomb the Iranian people the exact definition of genocide and suggested Congress invoke the 25th Amendment. Journalist Phoebe Wall Howard has been writing about this at her Substack, Shifting Gears. She's also a frequent contributor at the Detroit News. Phoebe, it's good to have you back.
It's good to be here.
You write about all kinds of topics of interest in Michigan: the auto industry, energy prices, offshore racing in the Great Lakes, and sometimes politics. Can I just ask what got your attention about some of the national media figures speaking out in this way against President Trump's foreign policy?
So as someone who used to cover politics full time in swing districts around the country, the current state of affairs, I think, has captured the imagination of every American and every Michigander. What we're noticing is sort of a silence. This is not, I would actually respectfully submit, this is not a partisan issue in Michigan, because it doesn't seem to really be affecting state races or local issues. This is very much a Washington issue, and people are feeling paralyzed. But what's most notable is how people are talking about Megyn Kelly, Tucker Carlson, Joe Rogan. I don't go to a social function with people of all ages. He's widely considered someone who speaks to both sides of the aisle. He's considered thoughtful and perceptive. But to your point, Marjorie Taylor Greene, these are people who are visceral and somehow connecting to voters on both sides of the aisle. And this war situation, particularly because we're surrounded by so many military families, I think that's why it's connecting. And what I learned in covering military families during the Iraq War is families don't feel comfortable criticizing any administration when their sons and daughters are overseas. So what you start noticing is a tremendous silence gripping families, gripping friends, and in social situations where subjects are changed and people just feel debilitated and very, very worried.
Can you put your finger on when you started to notice this was happening?
I would say in the run-up to this current conflict with Iran. And of course, you've got such an ethnic mix in the state of Michigan that people are also worried that weighing in on this latest situation will unintentionally alienate friends who are parts of these various ethnic groups. So people have family that are dying overseas here, not even associated with the U.S. military, but perhaps in Gaza and in Israel. So I'm meeting those people every week, and this is very, very disturbing in the swing state of Michigan.
One of the biggest military moves in this conflict, as I mentioned, is Iran's assertion of control over the Strait of Hormuz. That's sort of the pinch point for access to the Persian Gulf and oil-rich nations. I mean, that may seem like it's happening about a million miles away. But do you have any dots to connect for us about the connection between the Strait of Hormuz and the energy costs that people might be paying here in Michigan?
So we know that the people in Michigan are frugal. It doesn't matter how much or how little money you have, you watch your pennies. So what we've noticed, of course, is Enbridge stock is going up. It's consistently climbing and it's very steady. You don't have oil companies commenting on the current situation. But in terms of the price at the gas pump, interestingly, I just turned in a Rivian pickup truck and I was stopped multiple times a day from people who said they had never considered electric vehicles. They still don't like the concept of electric vehicles. But ironically, this current debate over oil and war involving oil and supply is actually getting people to really think about where are they going. I mean, I talked to two people this morning who are driving 20 minutes to go fill their gas tanks at a location they feel is more affordable. We are seeing this all over Metro Detroit in northern Michigan, but that is a really strange byproduct where people are talking about electric vehicles, where, of course, companies like Ford have dialed back with the Ford Lightning pickup. So, you know, the incentives are gone, but then you have families who come home and plug in the vehicle and aren't worried about gas prices. They're not paying attention to the gas prices.
Yeah. The context for this also, in addition to what you mentioned about the automakers kind of pivoting back out from EV transitions, is there are places in which the cost of a barrel of crude has about doubled. I think diesel drivers are especially paying the costs right now. You opened your essay with a friend in the faith community. You mentioned the fact that individual voters who, you know, who may be affected by this have been very quiet. Have you noticed anyone within clergy circles speaking out?
So it's really important to me as a writer to constantly talk to different religious denominations, because I think they have a pulse on the community that's often overlooked by the press. And so what's happening and what I'm hearing, particularly in the evangelical community, is that there is tremendous loyalty actually to the U.S. government and the current administration. But this situation is almost, it's causing people to re-examine everything in a way that hasn't been done since the last election, that people are asking, should they just pull themselves out of politics entirely, that the current state of affairs is so hard to reconcile in the religious community. So I talk to people every day who tell me they're praying more than they ever have. Different denominations and actually people who aren't religious have said they simply don't know what to do, and that's what they're choosing to do. But strangely, the number of religious families I've talked to who said all they can come up with is perhaps they should just completely withdraw from politics because they don't want to seem as if they're aligned with wrongdoing.
Yeah. I want to circle back for a moment to people with big megaphones in this moment. The conventional wisdom about quote unquote news commentators is that they give us a perspective on events of the day. When we see Tucker Carlson or Alex Jones or, I guess, Joe Rogan performing a turnaround on the administration, should we read that as an indication of them changing their minds about Trump's executive powers? Or do you think maybe what they're doing is signaling something that they see happening among typically Republican voters?
I think they're reflecting the public, these commentators, but more importantly, I think there is a consensus right now that it appears as if all these political commentators have given the benefit of the doubt, that everybody can agree and you can push the envelope, but that really it's a low risk exercise, that you get a big following and there are really no consequences to it, because at the end of the day, our democracy is strong. And I think you have very influential voices who are now really worried that they've been not asking questions or holding accountability. And they're really concerned, particularly because they make their money on speech. And we're seeing proposed legislation at the state level and federal actions that are really concerning to people who want to just speak out, whatever your opinion is, regardless of your political affiliation. I think that's what's scaring them, whether it is threatening pulling licenses or demanding that you make changes in content. They don't want to make changes in their content.
Can I ask you to draw on your experience as a politics reporter and maybe think about what this portends for midterm elections this year, maybe even for 2028?
I think that in the midterms in Michigan and nationally, we might expect to see a dramatic dip in participation, particularly on the Republican side. So we know that Nick Fuentes has begged and pleaded with Republican voters to please stay home, that he feels like it must signal to the GOP that new voices need to come in and they need to be more focused on domestic policies. So I suspect he could be influential in depressing turnout on the Republican side of the aisle. Democrats, in theory, are more motivated because they're angry. However, there's great division and complication because of loyalty and perceived disloyalty to the nation of Israel. That makes the entire Democratic debate much more complicated because there's fracturing among voters in Michigan and nationally.
Phoebe Wall Howard. You can find her recent writing about what she sees happening in the Michigan mainstream at her Substack, Shifting Gears. Always an enlightening read. She's also a frequent contributor at the Detroit News. Phoebe, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
We're going to take a break for just a minute now. After that, an Iranian in Michigan talks about communicating her culture through music.
As an artist, my work will no longer be just about, obviously, aesthetics or just the music itself, per se. It's going to be a refusal, an active refusal to be silenced.
That's next. You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We've been talking about the tense situation in the Persian Gulf, and while many of us have been mindful of the U.S.'s military action, this is an especially painful time for people with family ties and friends in Iran and around the region. Negar Dana Afazel was born in Tehran. She's been living and teaching in Kalamazoo for several years now. She's the founder of the Kalamazoo Violin Choir, where her young students perform folk tunes from all around the world. Negar is herself an accomplished violin soloist. She specializes in immersive performance projects. And this weekend, she and a collaborator have planned an event called A Conversation Through Us. Negar and a vocalist will assume the roles of different women throughout history. Negar Afazel, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me, April. It's a pleasure to be here.
I just want to acknowledge that we asked you here, of course, to talk about your work, but as people just heard me say, like, you're originally from Iran. And this is a week in which the American president has said some incredibly inflammatory things, and American military are in the midst of military attacks on Iran. I just wondered how you're doing.
Yeah, thank you so much for asking that. Obviously, this is an unimaginable time for, any immigrants from Iran. This has been just a very tumultuous few past months. First was the oppression of the regime itself, and then right after that was the attack of U.S. Israeli military on, you might say regime, but it's on the people. And so, yeah, I have family and friends there. The internet is shut off, so it's pretty. It's exhausting, obviously, and draining, and it is very difficult to manage and balance especially when you're not there and you can't get updates. You just see the news, and obviously it's very terrifying, and especially because in our world, sometimes you just open your eyes and you see really appalling rhetoric against, you can say humanity, because it's become so easy to just say in the day of in the light of day, I think, a public admission of intent to commit war crimes against a whole group of people, like saying things like saying a whole civilization will die tonight. So this is this is about my family, my friends, and my culture and heritage, and seeing this aggression becoming so normalized. It's very difficult to see, but at the same time, as an artist, it's a push for me to not be indifferent. As an artist, my work will no longer be just about obviously aesthetics or just the music itself per se. It's going to be a refusal, an active refusal to be silenced.
You've centered Iranian identity in your work in a lot of different ways. Personal experiences, personal identity, and traditions as well. I'm just curious about the kind of reactions that you've had from audiences as you've invited them into the culture a bit.
Yeah. So the first thing that I did, and that was a pretty substantial work, was a Woman, Life, Freedom, a monodrama for violin solo and female choir that was premiered a couple of years ago at Peabody Conservatory, where I got my DMA from. It was about a 60-minute long piece, and in collaboration with four other female composers for different places in the world. And it included Persian poetry. So the text was actually sung in Persian, written by a female Persian poet of the past in different eras, that was compiled by myself to kind of say a narrative. And it was inspired by the women-led movement back home, Woman, Life, Freedom, that was after the death of a young woman by the morality police of Iran a few years ago. And then the whole social movement and the bravery of Iranian women afterwards. So that was the first thing that I couldn't be there, but I wanted to use my work, to say something and to invite people to reflect on that. And those are also the themes that women everywhere around the world could connect to in different levels. I remember that even from the choir that I collaborated with, the composers and everybody, we had so many really just nurturing and supportive conversations about, just what does it even mean to sing in another language, for example, or the composers to understand the soul of those words when they were, writing their pieces for it. For example, one of the composers is actually Ukrainian, and we were talking just about this whole feeling of separation and oppression and not being able to really, just kind of scream what you want to say at the world. And it seems like always that the world is there, but not fully like seeing and hearing. And everything is just so momentarily and kind of like fragmented. So when we brought that work to the stage, I heard from the audience members also how the fact that they could hear a different language that actually helped the whole feeling of what was being said, because obviously I prepare always performance notes because, it obviously is needed to guide your participants around you to be able to follow that, what I call it now, a performance ritual, which is inviting the participants not to just sit and listen, but to be engaged in a psychological flow with you and to even kind of talk to them. So these are the elements that are kind of growing in my work. And I'm also like working on a different project now, again, related to my heritage, but it's through the story, an individual testimonial of my mother, actually, who has lived through war, revolution, and political imprisonment, and the oppression of the regime and everything else. But I am, as a young woman, from there, being separated and migrated, kind of like having heard all these things and experiences, kind of going through these pieces and fragments to find what it actually means to be connected to a heritage and to culture and to bear it through work, through words, and, you know, through whatever the future is having for me. But I think the audience and the participants always have been so so appreciative. I think it's been actually a pleasure for me to hear that, and that they can actually connect to these per se new things. I think one of the goals that I have is to kind of bring down this barrier between the performer or the performance artist and the participants who come in to watch, quote unquote. So I'm trying to kind of change these roles and break down any barriers that might be there. So actually these conversations will always be in flow after even the performances. I always wait after performances to talk to the audience, to hear what they thought, their reflections and their thoughts. And that's always inspiring on its own.
I love the frame of making it more of a dialogue, and also your framing of the performance as ritual. And I can tell that audiences have been shaped by this, and that you yourself, like, this has given you a place to put a lot of energy at a very difficult time. Would you say that these kinds of creative experiences have gone even further and maybe shaped your own sense of identity a bit?
Absolutely. So basically, I can't right now as my artist and teaching artist, kind of part of my individuality, cannot see that separated as what I do anymore. It's basically how I'm navigating everything that is happening around me or in the world. And that will be reflected to what I do, because you know how we talk about contemporary music and how we talk about contemporary art. I truly believe, and I have come to believe this, that doing something contemporary means to understand the contemporary audience and what you can bring to them to be relatable for them and to them. And so they can connect to it. And that is contemporary for me. It can be through, and that's why I am very interested in using so many different mediums, visual, audible, music, and all sorts of things, because I just feel like our world is so complex and layered now, with the individuals reflecting the micro complexity of that in their own kind of characters and daily lives, that we can't just say, okay, I'm going to perform this repertoire and please clap for me, and then now I'm done, and now I am a musician or like a performing artist. Some people might do that, and that's great, but that's just not what I want to do, and that's just not fulfilling for me. And so yes, that actually it has shaped my whole idea of my performing artist identity and teaching artist. So that's kind of what I do on a different level, with more appropriate language and kind of education with my young group. We still say stories, but our stories are, you know, bringing up themes that the children are dealing with or are hearing about. So it's relatable. They're hearing about immigration, war, peace, what is environment, what is going to happen to our earth. And we say these through original stories that I write in collaboration with my friend or myself. So, yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Nagar Dana Afazel. She is a violinist and composer and has a performance coming up on April 11th called A Conversation Through Us. You know, Nagar, this is like in the Western classical music tradition, it's very easy for performers to just sort of get captive to the canon and, you know, perform our older works. And, you know, maybe there's certainly an element of artistry and interpretation there, but, you know, sometimes they're in dialogue with the world we live in, sometimes less so. And, you know, Persian classical music is also a very, you know, ancient and storied tradition too. And I imagine a lot of the same considerations come up about, are we going to play the tradition or are we going to live it and interpret it? Can you maybe talk a little bit about your interest in the forms that you grew up learning, but also making them part of a contemporary view and contemporary ideas that you want to express through music?
Yeah, sure. So I have to start by saying that all my degrees, my undergrad, master's, and my DMA are actually in violin performance. So I grew up since I was like six or seven to just learn what it means to be a violinist. And that means that you have to know how to play in certain ways and certain things and just be good at it and kind of like just be able to compete with other people who are good at it too. But there hasn't really been enough talk of how about if you are good at it, only if you can find your voice, or let's help you to find what you want to do and all that. So that just doesn't have, that didn't have enough room. But right now, I think maybe it's a little bit better. And in academic places is what I'm talking about. So I finished my undergrad in Tehran University, and then I came to Michigan to do my master's. And then I went to Peabody to get my DMA. But then I realized that in live performance, this is where my heart is. I just love to be a live performer and to experience and bring experiences for myself and the participants in those moments. And it's not just as an elite or distant art, but it as a community ritual. And my goal, again, because I said it before, is to bring new multidisciplinary works and collaborations to this world, and to present a kind of society or world that we want to actually live in through these projects. And I know, as a young woman coming from Tehran, I know how it feels like to have a culture or a voice silenced and constantly having to fight for yourself to be heard. And that is why inclusivity and creating a welcoming, safe, and caring space are so personal to me, therefore really important. Whether it's I provide also Braille program notes in collaboration with a friend. It's a visual impairment or political cultural barrier. My goal is to break through them using my work I do in my community. So saying all these and coming to you, what your question is, actually, I am in a conversation through us. We are using that kind of quote unquote standard repertoire as well. There are composers such as, you know, Dario Mayo or Heitor Villa-Lobos or, Gustav Holst. But what is weaving these ones, I mean, I'm including my original pieces in here and there too, but it's kind of going to be an event and not just small pieces that are going to be played and then audience will clap after those. But the narration that is being said is going to bring those pieces and put them in a context that the audience can relate to. So it's not that always you have to just always bring new compositions, but you can do so much with what we already have and maybe shape them in a way that, you know, it's kind of like creating this friendship between tradition and innovation, right? There are two pillars and they have to be there, because without the tradition, I mean, it's, you can't get away from it, because this, my instrument, my physical instrument is built upon it. So I appreciate it. And it's the legacy of humanity. I mean, we got to the point that we could create this such beautiful thing out of wood that can sing and that can move, change, create. I mean, it's amazing. But how I can bridge that with innovation and to relate and to connect, I think that is what my main goal is.
I really love that you're drawing in composers like Mayo and Villa-Lobos. In their own ways, they were also artists who were not content to just rest on what had been done in their past, you know, but of speaking to their cultures and their contemporary situations. It's just all throughout their music. If people are preparing to come to the performance, is there anything that you'd say to prepare them for the narrative that flows through this?
Yeah, sure, I did. I could just say at the heart of this work for me has been the continuum womanhood and expressing the experiences of women throughout the history of humanity, but also just as humans. And so at the heart of this work is memory as a tool for ownership in an era that we live in defined by bold distances of digital screens, war, or separation. Our personal stories are at risk of becoming mere consumable data. So this performance is a reclamation of those stories. This is an invitation to stop observing, to start participating in a collective reflection on what it means to be human and an individual today in our world.
My guest today has been Nigar Dena Afazel. She'll be performing April 11th at First Congregational Church in Kalamazoo and at Trinity Lutheran Church in Kalamazoo on April 18th in concert with vocalist Trisha Teslov. And their performance is A Conversation Through Us. Nigar, thank you so much for joining us, and our thoughts are with you and your family.
Thank you so much for having me, April.
It's time for us to pause for just a moment. After that, we're going to revisit Detroit native Curtis Chin's memoir, which has been selected as the next great Michigan read. It's all about his experiences growing up in his parents' restaurant business.
Do I stay in this comfortable situation with my family and all the free Chinese food I could eat? You know, really wonderful situation, great food. But at the same time, the city is falling apart around us, you know, in the 80s.
That's coming up. You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. When Curtis Chin was growing up, his parents owned a very well-known spot on Detroit's map, Chung's Restaurant in Midtown. Curtis was an observant kid with an eye for the array of Detroiters stopping in for tangy spare ribs and almond boneless chicken. His witty, sometimes irreverent storytelling make for a very loving tour of the city in the 80s and the constellation of people populating Curtis's evolving consciousness, Diana Ross, Bruce Lee, and the actor Yul Brynner. Curtis Chin now lives in Los Angeles, where he writes and produces documentary films. His book, Everything I Learned in a Chinese Restaurant, has been chosen by Michigan Humanities as this year's Great Michigan Read. That's a statewide discussion for book clubs, libraries, and schools. This month, Curtis is touring libraries all across Michigan to talk about his work and his story. We talked to him when the book was published in 2023. You're involved in documentary film in your day job. And I find that when we're talking about true life stories, there are some people who have difficulty kind of seeing narrative in their own stories. They may think, oh, my situation was so specific. It doesn't really say anything larger. My situation, you know, the story of my life doesn't really matter. Was that ever an issue for you as you thought about your childhood as an adult?
You know, it's an interesting question. You know, as a documentary filmmaker, you're right. I don't normally like to appear on camera. I like to be behind the scenes and sort of analyzing the situation. I think with writing this particular memoir, because it started off really as a personal story directed towards my nieces and nephews, because, you know, my family had this long history in Detroit going all the way back to the late 1800s. But after my dad passed away, we all left. And as soon as my siblings started having kids, I really wanted them to know about that history because I just thought it was so colorful and vibrant and really shaped, you know, who our family was. And so in that sense, I was just telling small family stories. I wasn't necessarily thinking that this that it connected to this larger narrative of what's going on in the country these days. And so once I thought of that, then it became a much more difficult book to write, but one that I was committed to doing because I do think that there's a lot of things going on in our country these days that need addressing.
There are places in Detroit where history is sort of has been unfolding in place over a lot of time. But part of what has made the telling of Detroit's Chinatown's stories so complex is the fact that there has been siting and resiting and buildings, you know, whole neighborhoods, you know, sort of torn down and mowed down in the name of progress. So people may today not be as familiar with Chung's Restaurant, which was your family's place. Do you mind just saying a little bit about Chung's to set the table?
What was that old phrase? I pity the fool who who didn't get to try it out. It was just a classic Chinese chop suey joint. And it was opened by my great-grandfather in 1940. It was located in the original Chinatown over on 3rd Avenue by Corktown. But it switched when, as you mentioned, the city demolished the old Chinatown in lieu of the freeway. And so we relocated to what was called the New Chinatown, or what they were hoping to do was an international district. And that's pretty much where I grew up, in that location in the Cass Corridor. And it was just a fabulous restaurant. I mean, I really feel like that restaurant represented the city, right? Because during the day, our clientele was all the white collar workers from downtown, or the students from, you know, Wayne State, or the people from the medical center. But then at night, it really was the people that lived around the corridor. And so, yeah, I really got to see the whole city. And so that was really a nice, wonderful experience.
Kitchen time, as folks might imagine, was a big part of your life from an early age. And in the first part of the book, you talk about how you and your brothers hung out and did homework and helped out as directed. I might be making this sound a bit idyllic, but I really enjoyed reading about what you took in those years from observing your mom. Tell us a little bit about your mother.
Wow. My mom's probably one of the strongest figures in my life. She raised us, all six of us, and I always knew growing up that she had a hard life. I mean, part of it was observing it. And yes, part of it was her telling us that she had a hard life and, you know, really trying to push us to have more options in life. And we'd have these conversations just sitting in the back of the restaurant where I'd ask her about her view of the world. And she would always surprise me with her responses, and in a good way.
Later in the book, we kind of get a picture of her as maybe someone who was really interested in science and sciences education. Was maybe part of this book kind of thinking about her life in a different way, too?
I think that she is a person who didn't have very many choices in life, given her circumstances, being a woman, being born in China, being a middle child. She really never felt that she had much agency in life. And I think that the one thing that she felt that she could contribute was through her kids. Her interests really were in the sciences, but actually more in the math, because that's what she really excelled at. From a very young age, she would give us math problems at the back of the restaurant. So if you've ever gone to a Chinese restaurant and you see a little kid sitting in the back doing extra homework, that was me growing up at Chung's.
Yeah. You tell this story in the book about one of the restaurant's cooks, a guy named Heng Suk. And in it, you share an awful lot of information about the diversity of people that you met in Chinatown and the relative lack of safety. Later on, you talked about someone putting graffiti with an anti-Japanese slur on the apartment that your family was supposed to take. Curtis, what was the cost of all this on your parents trying to navigate you and the other kids through that kind of experience?
Well, the opening line to the book is, "Welcome to Chung's, for here to go." I mean, that's a common phrase that you hear anytime you enter a Chinese or any type of restaurant, right? And I try to add extra heft to that line, because that really was the theme growing up. Do I stay in this comfortable situation with my family and all the free Chinese food I could eat? You know, really wonderful situation, great food. But at the same time, the city is falling apart around us. You know, in the 80s, it was a really, really difficult time for the city, right? You had the auto industry that was struggling. You had crack cocaine. You had AIDS on the horizon. I personally knew five people murdered by the time I was 18 years old. But despite that, we had this really wonderful restaurant that made it hard to say, we're just going to abandon Detroit. And obviously, as I get older and I'm discovering my own sexuality, and how does that fit into the picture, you know, and how does that complicate my notion of whether or not I could stay, not just in Detroit, but also with my family in this restaurant?
Yeah. If you're just joining us, my guest is Curtis Chin. He's a writer and producer of documentary films, raised in Detroit, lives in L.A. now, and his new book, publishing October 17th, is Everything I Learned in a Chinese Restaurant. You talk in the book extensively about this long process of coming to terms with your sexual identity. And there was this guy in your life who relatively early on, served as a sort, I mean, he was a crush, but also a sort of model of a different kind of masculinity. Do you mind telling a little bit about Mr. Ma?
I can't talk about him without my heart melting a little bit,
even
after all these years. So it's really difficult. He was our fry cook. So he was sort of in the corner right by the door. And so I'd hang around with him a lot. Even just now, thinking about him 40 odd years later, my heart still flutters a little bit. So yeah. I don't know what else you want me to say.
Well, I mean, it sounds like you two never really had a conversation. I mean, it sounds like he recognized what was going on with you. And, you know, he was nice to you, definitely. Do you think that in any way, even though there wasn't anything overt spoken between you two, I mean, how important was it just to see people who, you know, there was this rapport with, even if you couldn't, if there wasn't anything cooked enough in your own identity to say, oh, I'm queer and so is he, and I'm attracted to this guy. Do you think it was important to have someone like him in your life?
You know, I'm just thinking back, like, do I feel that he was special to me over anybody else? Or was he just a nice guy to everybody? I don't know. And I don't know if he sensed that I was attracted to him. I mean, he did come from San Francisco, so maybe he might have been more aware of these type of things. But keep in mind, this is like in the 80s, right? Where people weren't as visible, the cues that we send out weren't as well known or as commonplace. I just feel like he's just a really nice guy who made me laugh, and just someone who paid attention to me was really important, because, you know, I grew up in a big house, right, with 10 people, if not more, at any one time. And, you know, oftentimes I felt lost, but he was just really good about paying attention to the little details about me. I just think any kid just needs someone to listen to them, right?
Adults other than parents who sort of see them a little bit.
Exactly. You know, I mean, we had 6 kids. I wasn't the oldest. That was Craig. I wasn't the golden child, which was Chris. I wasn't Calvin, the one who went to Yale eventually. I wasn't Cindy, the only girl. And I wasn't Clifford, who was, you know, the youngest boy. So I felt like all of them had something special about them. And I always went through thinking, oh, I'm just this middle child, this Jan Brady syndrome, right? You know, Marsha, 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 Marsha type of thing. And so suddenly there's this guy who actually did pay attention to me.
Curtis, you talked about the fact that you were aware of street crime and of hate crime as a young person. You know, you knew of murder as a thing that was happening in your city and in your neighborhood. And you were also a young kid when Vincent Chin was murdered. And while you two weren't like personal friends or anything, you knew of him, at least, and his mom, Lily. It's pretty evident how terrifying that period must have been for people in the community worried about their kids. Do you mind saying a little bit about what it was like to be a young person when Vincent Chin was murdered by some white auto workers?
So this was during the height of the anti-Japanese sentiment in the 80s, where a lot of car companies were laying off people. People were losing their homes. And, you know, Asians became a very easy scapegoat, not just amongst, you know, the rank and file workers, but also amongst the leadership. And so it was a challenging time. But again, growing up in that Chinese restaurant in Chinatown, I did feel safe. I felt like that was a little cocoon. Obviously, when Vincent was murdered, that sort of shattered that. But still, at that time, my response was really, well, what are we going to do about it? And so one of the things that I noticed really early on was the lack of media coverage to the Vincent Chin case in the Chinatown community, but also nationally. The Vincent Chin case for Asian Americans is a very pivotal moment along the levels of a Emmett Till. But yet a lot of people still haven't heard about it. It took a total, I think, of like 12 days before anybody reported about it. And this is after this guy was in the hospital for 4 days struggling for his life. You know, nobody thought to cover that. And so I started writing letters to the editor trying to get them to cover it. But, you know, sadly, I was 14 years old and not a very good writer at that time. And so nothing ever got published. But that's really what set me on this course of understanding the importance of storytelling. Because I honestly believe if the media had done a better job of covering the story, I don't think the judge would have let these killers off with a $3,000 fine and never having served a single day in jail.
Yeah. There's an astonishing story. Maybe I don't know how astonishing it is to anyone who's experienced this kind of misidentification before, but you tell this story later of a white teacher in one of your classes later calling on you as Vincent. I mean, what that does to a teenager to be misidentified by a dead young man's name who just happens to be also ethnically Chinese. It's just, wow.
I think that's pretty common. I think I was always getting misidentified as somebody else, usually often my brother, you know, but I think that when you're a person of color, you know, and you're in an area that's majority some other community, they say it. People don't mean to be mean or awful or anything about that, right? I mean, it just happens, but it still hurts or it still confuses you, you know, even though the intention isn't to be a jerk, it just happens sometimes, right? Mm-hmm. And we all do it, I think.
The book relays an awful lot of warmth in your family and just life and times at the restaurant. But also, it's evident that you were wrestling with how and when to come out to your family. And I just wonder, as you got into your early adulthood, whether you recognized a level of compartmentalization that you'd had to do in your life.
Well, my family never really exhibited any outward homophobia. They never said anything anti-gay. And in fact, you know, they were very friendly with all our gay customers. But yet at the same time, I didn't feel safe coming out, because even if you're 99% sure that your family's probably going to react well, you just don't want to take that 1% chance, because you just don't want to lose your family. My staying in the closet had more to do with that and my fear of also disappointing my family, you know, particularly my mom, because again, she had sacrificed so much of her life that I was just afraid of disappointing her. I was never really afraid of, like, well, what happens if I were to get kicked out? Would I be able to be independent and be on my own? Yeah. But my staying in the closet really was about protecting them more so than this need of me having to assert myself or feeling like I was a less than person if I didn't come out.
One of the most poignant parts of the book for me was reading about your question that you referenced early on, you know, is this for here to go? And I think a lot of Americans who grew up in families with relatively recent immigrant stories, like, there's this whole thing of being at home away from the previous generation's home, or at home from their own home. And it was so striking that there you were trying to figure out whether and when and how you should leave, where there were people in your own family who'd had to ask that question relatively recently. I mean, obviously, you're still living in Los Angeles now. How do you look back on that decision and how you eventually made it?
I mean, as someone who's left the Detroit area for a good number of years now, right, 30 odd years, I still think about this. It's not a done deal when you leave a place that you love. So our restaurant closed in 2000 in the location that, you know, I grew up in. And then recently it got sold. And the new owner actually went out of the way to track me down in L.A. to ask me if I would revive this restaurant, because the restaurant was so well known in Detroit, right? It really was iconic. And, you know, I have to admit, there was a 5% of me that thought, like, oh, could I go back to Detroit and reopen the restaurant? And so I don't know if these are ever settled things in ourselves, right? I think in summation, I do think that it was the right decision. I mean, because I've had so many great opportunities in life. But at the same time, you know, I do feel this sadness that, you know, I'm one of those people that did leave and didn't fight to improve my hometown, right? And to, you know, make sure that Detroit was coming back strong.
The book is really enjoyable to read, but I just wondered what you hope people will take away from it.
Like I said, it's a love letter to Detroit, but I also want my book to sort of help with the conversation that we're having in this country right now. You know, we're having these really deep, serious conversations, and basically what it's done is it's polarized our country. I don't think we can avoid some of these topics, but I do think that we should try to find a better way to do it so that we can come back together at the end of the day. And I think Chinese restaurants actually offer a wonderful opportunity, because they're one of those few places in the country where you can actually walk in and be seated next to someone who's from a different race, religion, socioeconomic background. And if you just took the moment to sort of say hi to them, that would be a great step forward. The way I sort of pitched this book to my agent was, you know, come for the egg rolls, but stay for the talk on racism.
writer Curtis Chin. He has visits planned across Michigan in the next few weeks, including one tonight in Battle Creek, Saturday in Grand Rapids, Lansing on Sunday, and more. For more information, you can visit the Michigan Humanities website. That's all for Stateside for today. I'm April Barrett. It's good to have you with us. We'll see you again tomorrow.